ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Well, everyone warned her it was a bad idea when best-selling author Bianca Bosca wanted to insert herself in the art world. As a child, she painted obsessively, even showed her work in local art shows. But after moving to New York, the art galleries felt like exclusive private parties, and she was no longer invited. She spent 5 years working in the art scene as a gallery assistant, even as a security guard at the Guggenheim Museum, to discover or rediscover the importance of beauty and how appreciating art becomes practice for appreciating life. Her new book is called Get the Picture, a mind-bending journey among the inspired artists and obsessive art fiends who taught me how to see. Bianca Bosca joins me now. Hi.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
Oh, really nice to meet you. Why do you think so many people were trying to warn you off taking a deep dive into the art world?
Well, I think part of it is that there is a sort of strategic snobbery that reigns in the art world. And that doesn't just apply to journalists, although it certainly didn't help that I was a journalist. But, you know, I think that the art world kind of views secrecy as key to its survival. And so I started showing up. I should say I had this goal. Like a lot of journalists, I do interviews, I read research reports, but I also believe in learning by doing. And so I had this admittedly ambitious goal that I wanted to go work in the art world and then share what I learned. Mm. And as you said, people were skeptical. They tried to warn me off of it. They, in many cases, refused to speak to me. And you know, I think that there is a sort of mafia-like omerta vow of silence, excuse me, in the art world. And part of it has to do with the fact that there are a lot of things that would pass for, you know, absurd, unethical, obsessive, illegal anywhere else. And if you haven't taken a vow of silence to keep those secrets, you're a risk.
Gosh, and looking back, do you think the exclusion that you felt from that art scene, was the problem with the art scene or was it with you? Was it the pretentiousness of the scene or was it perhaps some of your own fears?
Yeah, so I have to say, as I eventually started working in the art world, I did discover just how ingrained this strategic snobbery is. You know, I think that there are these deliberately erected barriers to entry that exist to keep out the rest of us. And those run the gamut. I mean, I started, one of my first gigs was working for this very cool up-and-coming gallery in Brooklyn, where while painting walls and writing press releases, my boss began to suggest that I needed a makeover, right? You know, severe haircut, new jewelry. It was suggested that I tone down my superficial enthusiasm. If you've spent any time around the art world, you may also know that you know, true art connoisseurs tend to discuss art in this affectless monotone that makes them sound like they're running out of batteries. You know, there is a sort of approved language to art. Like I was advised to nix certain words from my vocabulary. A work is not sold, it's placed. But then, you know, even things like where galleries are located, a lot of them are located less like stores than speakeasies. You know, they're on the second floor, third floor. You really won't see them from street level. And as one gallerist explained to me, you know, it's not just because a street level storefront is more expensive. It's because if you're not on the street level storefront, you don't have to deal with random people walking in. But, you know, galleries will refuse to sell you an artwork, even if it's for sale. They tend not to list their prices. While you're judging the art, they're judging you. Gosh. And I think I was frustrated. You know, a lot of my goal was to develop an eye. Artists told me I lacked visual literacy, which they said was downright dangerous in a world so saturated with images. And I think that these deliberately erected barriers to entry, frustratingly, also apply to appreciating the art. You know, we're sort of told that you cannot, I think many connoisseurs sort of embrace this idea that If you haven't spent years going to art fairs or, memorizing artist biographies, or if you don't wear the right pair of jeans, you don't have what it takes to properly commune with the painting. And I actually disagree with that.
Love that phrase, by the way. Lacks visual literacy. I think I found my Twitter bio. So for you, for you, how did a watercolor of Dancing Carrots reawaken your desire to sort of look again at art and what it adds to our lives?
Yeah, so as you alluded, art had been a passion of mine growing up, but by the time I reached adulthood, it had been many years that we were not on speaking terms. Going to galleries and museums reliably made me feel like I was, two tattoos and a master's degree away from figuring out what was going on. I would turn the corner in some beautiful gallery with hushed rooms and bright lights and perfect walls. Discover a bunch of people thoughtfully contemplating, say, a sculpture of rotten vegetables on a stained mattress, and felt like, everyone got the punchline except me. And I can't imagine that much would have changed, except I was back home, my childhood home in Oregon on the West Coast, United States, helping my mom clean out the basement when I discovered my late grandmother's dancing carrots. And this was a painting that she had made inspired by her time as a Holocaust survivor in a displaced persons camp in Austria after the war. And she had no artistic background that I know of. She had no children of her own. She had studied economics. And yet she started teaching art classes to the children. And one of the things she did was to organize these dance performances where they ended up dressing up as carrots. And so, those carrots haunted me. They followed me back to my home in New York, and they kept dancing my brain around this idea of why my grandmother had treated art, arguably the least essential thing, as essential. And so I started trying to reconnect with art. I thought maybe it would go better this time around. And while the art still befuddled me, the people fascinated me. I'd never met a group of people willing to sacrifice so much for something of so little obvious practical value. I am someone very obsessed with obsession. And there were these artists who treated 100-year-old paintings like they were as necessary as vital organs. And I was surprised to discover that scientists are actually right there with artists in telling us that art is a fundamental part of being human, as one biologist puts it, as necessary to us as food or sex. And so, I just became consumed with this question of why art? Why does art matter? How can any of us engage with it more deeply? And I wanted to see if I could see art, if I could see the world the way these art lovers did, and what would change if I could. So yeah, I decided to throw myself in, despite the threats and despite the warnings.
And you've said, I love this quote, so much about the world is magnified by the art world, the way we judge quality, the extreme wealth disparities, the power of gatekeepers. Was that something you believed going into the project, or did you come out with that conclusion?
I came out with that conclusion. I mean, I think that it's the art world is in some ways a microcosm of the broader world in all of these different ways. I think one area that is a bit confounding and a bit different, though, and does relate to this question of how we look at art, is when it comes to matters of context. So, what was very interesting to me is as I was trying to develop my eye, the art connoisseurs that I was meeting, I began to discover that they spent surprisingly little time discussing the merits of the artworks themselves. And instead, they asked questions like, where did this artist go to school? What gallery have they shown at? Who's shown their work? Who is he sleeping with at the moment? All of that is the so-called context around an artist, sort of the web of names, it's the social cachet. And that context seemed to influence people's opinions of the work even more than the creation itself. There was a dealer that I worked with whose go-to question when it came to whether to show an artist was, is this someone I want to hang out with? And I thought what was interesting about that emphasis on context is, first of all, it was frustrating. I felt like I was trying to develop my eye, and instead I was being told to sort of outsource my opinion to the hive mind. And then again, it felt like kind of a deliberate barrier to entry. It made the connoisseurs all that, more important as these gatekeepers to sort of tell us what we were experiencing in the art. And I think that it's different. Of course, context affects our judgment almost in every area of life, in almost every industry that we're in. But what's surprising to me is that in the art world, rather than sort of trying to acknowledge the sort of bias that context causes, there was almost this willingness, this overeager impulse to embrace it. I remember someone telling me, if you don't understand the context, you can't understand what you're looking at, right? Now, I am optimistic. I'm very happy to report that that isn't everyone. I was very excited to discover a rebel alliance of artists, but also gallerists and curators who really believe that art, even cutting-edge art, is for everyone, that it is not a luxury, but a necessity, and that everything you need to have a meaningful experience of art is right in front of you.
So, did you come around a little bit to that idea, though, that you can't separate art from context, that the context is part of the piece?
I think that for me, the guiding question of this journey for me was really, why does art matter and how can any of us engage with it more deeply? And I think that there are many answers to those questions. And certainly, there's no wrong way to look at art. And so I hope that readers of the book will agree that I present many different answers to those questions. And certainly, if context is your thing and that's, the way that you enjoy finding your way into art, that's great. I felt like I had a real breakthrough in my ability to see art on my own terms and to be able to brush away context when I started working as a studio assistant for up-and-coming artists. And, I was sitting on the grounds of their studios, stretching canvases and painting backgrounds when something clicked. And I think that, the last 100 years or so, we've been told that what really matters about an artwork is the idea behind it. The thought trumps the thing. And yet, all that kind of hushed murmuring about indexicality and, modernism and post-postmodernism that goes on in galleries hadn't prepared me for the blistery business of actually making art. Art making is practically athletic. And as one artist, Julie Curtis, who I worked for, told me, an idea is not a painting. Painting is constant decision making. And so I think that working for artists helped me understand how to savor art like an artist. And that meant slowing down, paying attention to the physical form and examining the artist's decisions. And so for me, when I went back to look at art in galleries and museums, for the first time in my life, I ignored the wall labels, the sort of, paragraph-long explanation oftentimes posted next to an artwork. And instead, I forced myself to stay in the work, to focus on the artist's decisions. And I took an artist's suggestion to just challenge myself to notice five things in a work, and those didn't have to be grandiose, like this is a, commentary on feminism and the social media age. It could just be like, this green makes me want to lick it, like I can't look away from this little splotch in the right-hand corner. And I think that for me, I mean, I think that examining an artist's decisions is really, I found such a valuable pathway into a piece. For me, it was a way to really brush away the context, ignore that strategic snobbery, and engage with the work on my own terms. I really felt like I was able to see art face to face with less pretense and more magic than I ever had before.
This is great stuff, Bianca. If you've just tuned in, I'm talking to Bianca Bosca. Her new book is called Get the Picture: A Mind-Bending Journey Among the Inspired Artists and Obsessive Art Fiends Who Taught Me How to See. Just one more question on context, which is, you were talking about dealers not wanting to sell to certain people. Does a person who buys a piece or where a piece is placed, does that affect the context of the artwork in that world?
Are you an art dealer? Because you're absolutely right. Certainly. I mean, I think that's part of the pickiness. So I worked for a dealer whose term for the general public was Joe Schmo. And there is an element where, if you want to buy an artwork, many galleries will sort of make you take a Schmo detector test. And so they'll want to know, like, what else do you own? How do you make your money? I worked with a dealer who recoiled at selling to people who worked in certain sectors of finance. And so, yeah, like the person who owns the work, their whole reputation is context for the work. As a writer, I was context. People, I feel like everyone is sort of wanding each other with these context Geiger counters. And I was certainly no exception. I will say, as a sort of final note on context, I do think that it dawned on me that part of the reason that it's so tempting to rely on context is because that's how our brains work. We do not go around seeing the world like video cameras, like dispassionately and accurately recording the scenes around us. Our brains are really these trash compactors, and we have these filters of expectation that descend over the raw data coming in to preemptively filter, sort, prioritize, dismiss that information even before our brains get the full picture. And what I think is really exciting, something that really resonated with me, is that artists and scientists have reached similar explanations for why art is so crucial to the human experience. And that is that art helps us fight those reducing tendencies of our minds. Art helps us lift the filter of expectation. It's not always pleasant, but part of what it does is it introduces a glitch that is a gift, a glitch that helps our minds jump the curb. And, there's no velvet ropes or made-up language necessary to do that. So I came to believe that there's ultimately an artist in each of us to the extent that we struggle to keep our brains from reducing and compressing our experience of the world. Art is a choice, it's a fight against complacency, and it's a decision to live a life that's more unexpected, more mind-blowing, and ultimately, I think, more beautiful.
I'm interested in the differences between masterpieces and unknown pieces. And it sounds like you had your sort of epiphany by spending time around emerging artists. So, how did you feel about seeing visitors flock to, for example, Marc Chagall's Paris Through the Window, an established masterpiece from 1913, compared to, say, something from an unknown artist?
Yeah, so I would say that I very quickly gravitated towards the part of the art world that dealt with up-and-coming emerging artists. I think to me that is the highest stakes but least covered part of the art world. That's where people are like elbowing their way into art history, and you're sort of seeing art history getting made before it's gotten romanticized and cleaned up. I will say that, as a guard and as someone who spent years going through this world, to the extent that I had a nearly naked stranger sit on my face in the name of art,
Gosh.
I did come to this point where I believe that there's a lot to be gained, I think, by spending a bit less time with the quote unquote masterpieces and more time with the under-celebrated art, the unexpected art. I think that as someone who's sold art and worked in museums, I had the ability to sort of see how the art machine works. I really wanted to see and got to see in the course of this journey, how does an artwork go from being the germ of an idea in someone's studio to this piece that we fawn over in a museum? Because I felt like all the decisions that affect that artwork are also decisions that affect us, like our idea of what art is or why we should engage with it. And there are many flaws in the machine. What ends up on the walls of hallowed art institutions, those end up there because of the decisions being made by individuals who are biased and flawed and subjective, just like any of us. They're having to make compromises. And so, we can't assume that the work on these spotless white walls is the best just because it's in a fancy room. In the end, I think the only eye you can trust in your own. And I do believe that is a very important part of developing our eye. It means challenging ourselves, going beyond the museums, going to galleries in someone's basement, in someone's living room, going to art schools. Museums are sort of encyclopedias of taste. These are works that many people in a very particular period of time could agree on. But going out to, where these up-and-coming artists are making their work, it's like being in a scientist's lab. Like, things are unexpected, they're not entirely figured out. I at least relish going on that adventure, and I hope other people will do so as well.
Bianca, is beauty essential to art?
I think beauty is essential to life. I think that, beauty is has been sort of persona non grata in polite society for the last century or so. Beauty in the art world, but also, kind of in intelligentsia circles more broadly, has been viewed as suspect, as passé, as both corrupted and corrupting, and, falling for its charms, sort of the sign of moral weakness. One of the things I will say about this journey for me is it not only transformed my relationship with art, but it transformed my relationship with the world. I mean, I came to really understand the way that looking is an adventure. And I will say that, I had a real identity crisis with my own sense of taste along the way. But coming out the other side, I'm so grateful for the way that art has taught me to see beauty in places where I never did before. And I do think that beauty, far from being passé, is essential. And beauty doesn't have to be physical. It doesn't have to be, again, the visual equivalent of a vanilla cupcake. Beauty, to me, it's something that simply pulls you close to it. You know, it draws you deeper into life. It nudges you to a place where you're wondering about, you know, the world and your place in it. I think beauty, like art, is sort of that moment when our brain escapes the well-worn pathways. And I think an artwork can be beautiful. I think a sunset can be beautiful. Planes landing, math equations. But I discovered in the course of working with the artist Julie Curtis that, in fact, a sewage treatment plant at the outskirts of Brooklyn can also be beautiful. That was not expected to me, but I'm so grateful to her and to art for helping me discover beauty where I never saw it before.
Could we finish with some suggestions from you on ways for the rest of us to visit a museum or an art gallery and not feel like an uninvited guest?
So I will say, if it's any consolation, it's not just you. I've been there, but press forward. It is worth it. You know, I do hope that in some sense the book will help people sort of take control of their own relationship with art and feel less intimidated by sort of spelling out the hidden logic of the art world and sort of explaining how these things work. You know, I think it becomes sort of like seeing an actor put zombie makeup on. My hope is that by sort of explaining how that strategic snobbery works, we can help people make up their own rules and perhaps change the system. But you know, I will say, this was a big change for me, but I became a big advocate and a big fan of ignoring the wall text. When I worked as a security guard at the Guggenheim Museum, I will confess that I actually started standing in front of the wall labels so that people wouldn't read them, because I felt like, you know, as one artist put it, you know, it's like a wall label. It's like, you know, you're trying to have a conversation with the artwork, but someone keeps interrupting. You know, I think that they're sort of like the answer key at the bottom of a word search. It sort of give this idea there's also one right answer. And I will say that when people just slowed down and trusted themselves, their interpretations went wild. They were amazing. So I would suggest to people, you know, first of all, slow down. There's studies that show that we spend four times longer reading the wall text than actually looking at the art itself, about 8 seconds versus 2 seconds looking at the work. And, you know, spend 5 minutes, spend 15 minutes, spend 50 minutes. You know, I spent hours around these pieces when I was a security guard, and I kept discovering something new. I would also say, you know, just pay attention to the artist's decisions when you're looking at an artwork. Take that sort of challenge that an artist shared with me to just notice five things in a work. But ultimately, and I also think it's about challenging your eye. You know, see a lot of things, but also see things that you aren't expecting, see things that you've never seen before, see things that you're not sure that you'll like. And have fun in the process. I'm very excited for you all to go on that journey and see what else you will see in the world when you step back out.
Yeah, I love that. And I also love your note that perhaps a museum or a gallery isn't the place to go. You say you should get as close to the source as possible. And what we actually see in those institutions is, in your words, the result of many decisions by flawed human beings. One way to get around that is to widen your horizon. So perhaps it is going to see an exhibition at your local high school or someone who's painting in their garage, whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. And don't feel obligated to see every single thing in a museum. I mean, I used to feel like scorched earth viewing was the only way to get my money's worth. I have to see every single thing. You know, it's sort of like going to an all-you-can-eat buffet and then wondering why you feel sick afterwards. Like, it's a, you know, if you go in and there's one work that you really bond with, you've done it. You know, like that's it. And let yourself linger on that one work. But yeah, widen your horizons. Like, there's so much art everywhere. And so much of it is great. I think the art world sort of, you know, maintains this idea that genius is in short supply, and I don't agree.
I've loved chatting to you. The book's called Get the Picture, a mind-bending journey among the inspired artists and obsessive art fiends who taught me how to see. And the author is Bianca Bosca. Thanks for your great work.
Thank you so much for having me. It's such a pleasure speaking with you.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.